What is real? How do you define real?
You can't jump into cash. Cash is trash. What do? You get out.
Ben Prentice, artist, linguist, Austrian economist, time chain maximalist, who understands the paradigm of a world with Bitcoin, and the co-founder of the website, the newsletter, and the important and crucial meme, What the Fuck Happened in 1971, which you can find at WTF1971.com. Welcome to the Bitcoin Matrix podcast, Ben. How are you?
Thank you, sir. Just a small correction there. My bio says armchair economist, mind you.
Yeah, I changed it. I was tempted to say armchair economist, but I think of you as more than that. So I really wanted to, and I know you study economics and specifically Austrian economics. So I did tweak it there a bit. I hope that's okay with you. I've been looking forward to this conversation for a really long time. The meme is really important to me. From when I first started to notice it, I think in around the spring of 2019. It's just very striking to me. It's, I think, the second most important meme to me outside of Bitcoin. I think the conversation goes much further. And that's kind of where I wanted to take it. I wanted to go a little bit more broad, broad strokes, more wide ranging, and really talk about inflation and central banking and the history of those things, maybe in the world, and then we'll kind of zoom in more towards like in the U.S. And you put up a tweet. Inflation is a source of most problems society faces today. Real costs decline, prices rise, but wages don't. This illusionary phenomenon has disrupted all exchange, entrepreneurship, workers, savers, and borrowers. It's corrupted our lives and culture. So this stuff seems really important. So, kind of like tee it off. What is inflation and how long has this been going on? I gather it's been going on a lot longer than since 1971.
Well, that's very true, Cedric. Inflation to an economist is an increase in the supply of money. And in fact, for the 5,000 year history of money, we'll tell you a history of inflation. Probably most of your listeners have read Safe's book, the Bitcoin Standard, and it goes over some inflationary histories of money, including the glass beads and many other things. So inflation is nothing new, right? But what the world kind of did was it converged, independently disparate cultures converged on gold because it had the least inflation. Even gold has a few percent inflation, but that's percentage of the total supply. We're not talking about CPI inflation here. That's the other word that people know well as inflation, which is a measure of a specific basket of goods, which can arbitrarily change according to the body that decides what the CPI is. And that's a rise in prices. And in that same thread, I mentioned that there's an inextricable link between the increase in the supply of money and the increase in a price of something because of the law of supply and demand. Saying all that, there are some misconceptions here because people talk about price inflation, people talk about monetary inflation. I argue that specifically, the CPI inflation doesn't reflect what's really happening. I think that most prices should be going down. So there are these deflationary forces and inflationary forces. So it can be kind of an illusory kind of phenomenon there. And the other part of that tweet that you read is actually the part about it disrupting entrepreneurs and corrupted our lives and our culture. That is actually drawn from our godfather, Lord Keynes, right? Who we all love and honor so much, Mr. Keynes. But he wrote, to be fair, he wrote that there's no surer way to debauch the society than with inflation, right? I don't remember the direct quote right this moment, but he understood that inflation was very bad. And I could talk probably for a very long time about how I think it's bad, but I don't know, which little tributary down the rabbit hole you want to go here. So
Well, you know, you said something, a couple of things that really clicked for me, you know, 5,000 year history of money. And I think I want to kind of skip forward more towards gold. And what I want to stipulate and what the light bulb really went off for me there is that you the notion that humans intrinsically understand inflation as demonstrated by our arrival of choosing gold. So there's some sort of principle understanding here with just inflation and sort of the natural maybe principle of that. So now, you know, now we're in the world with where we've chosen gold and we have powerful people who have the ability to either mint, verify, store, allocate, distribute, collect the gold. So, you know, what is coin clipping? And do you think it makes me feel like the kings and the masters of powers really understood what they were doing more than just kind of getting rich quick?
Right. Okay. So one kind of small, not really correction, but yeah. I use the word choose very loosely. Mm. You know, the societies chose gold, but
right, emergently.
Emergently, and right. and SAFE I think sums that up very well. That you know, there's no right or wrong choices of money. That's one of his quotes, and then but choices have consequences. And then another one of his quotes is the you can't insulate yourself from the consequences of others holding money that is harder than yours, right? So that's that's how gold got chosen, because the people that held gold did well and everyone else is like, oh, maybe we should hold gold too. And it became very liquid that way, and obviously network effects and blah 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 blah. What was the second part of your question there? You said
more around, so you know, now that people can control this and do more top down sort of monetary principles and policies, you know, I always wonder how much these masters of powers understand this intrinsically, and how much they're, you know, thinking long term with these moves, whether it's kind of like maybe along the conversation of democracy versus monarchies. I mean, monarchies have skin in the game. I mean, if you coin clip forever, you're going to destroy your kingdom, you know, right. But at the same time, maybe some of these people who had power and sat in these seats don't understand the long-term implications of what they're doing.
Yeah, I tend towards the latter there. You know, you ask what coin clipping is, it's taking small, this is the term debasement comes from this, where you're taking small amounts of the base metal out of the coin, where it still looks, it's relatively round, it looks about the same shape. So it's still, you know, as a verification, right? As verifiability is one of the qualities of money. As a verification, you look at the coin, it looks pretty similar, but there's less metal in it. And so it's a very hidden way to inflate the money supply. But I think this is all very easy to understand just from the fact that money, the temptation to print money should never be underestimated, right? Like if you were in a tough spot and you had the ability to print money, you probably do it, right? Like, I know you seem like a nice guy, Cedric, but let's be honest, like, you know, if you just had a, you know, like, hey, we can save everybody, we just print a little bit of money, and we saw a lot of that this year. And I think you see that throughout history, that when there is the ability to do so, that people will. And that's the same story of coin clipping as it is today, where, oh, well, we got to keep printing money. And now it's gotten us on this train where that because the money supply is inflating and we have this like systemic inflation, as a rule, that it turns the whole idea of debt kind of on its end, I think, because, you know, now it makes more sense to take out debt and then pay it back with the inflated dollars. And now that we've accumulated all this debt, well, it puts us in a really tough place. We're kind of in the between a rock and a hard place where there's no good option. And the quote unquote lesser of two evils seems like printing more money to prevent short-term pain, but really the lesser of the two evils in the long run would be allowing the markets to come back to reality, letting the money supply contract, but that would be very, very painful. So it goes back to that whole temptation thing. So I think it's much easier to understand that, you know, yes, there are evil actors, and yes, some of them have power, and maybe some of these, you know, 6102 or some of these things were actually people that, you know, were looking out for themselves, for sure. But to think that, you know, there's this, you know, been this cabal of people that have lasted for 5,000 years that have, you know, made it their mission to just inflate money, I think is kind of not really looking at it realistically, it's just a matter of incentives that that kind of keeps happening.
Yeah, I think my working hypothesis is that the names attached to some of these decisions, like 6102 or the closing of the gold window with Nixon in 1971, are not really the true attribution of these ideas and machinations of the levers of power. Mm-hmm. And so I'm always trying to figure out, like, who's really making that decision behind the scenes. And it's not so much I'm looking to look at any one particular president or anybody specifically and be like, let's find the guy. But I'm just trying to understand the seat of power.
Well, I think it's that same story over and over again, though, because, you know, whatever happened in the 1920s where they decided, you know, well, I know what happened in 1913. We established the Federal Reserve and made it much more viable to be able to print money. And then there was a world war and we started printing money and it felt great. I have a thread about this recently. I think you just tweeted one of the quotes from about comparing 1920s to the 2020s. And we all started drinking and partying. And then what happened is 1929, then the hangover hit. And instead of really, you know, going cold turkey and getting off of the inflation drug, what we did was we really started drinking a little bit more. And the way that we did that is something that Colin, the heavily armed clown that was on your show, one of the first few episodes, number two or something like that, he always talks about the suspension of redemption of specie, right, otherwise known as a bank holiday. And that's what 1929 was. And that's what 1933 was. And that's what 1971 was. And in a way, 1944 as well. I mean, what they keep doing is repricing the base money, the gold. And in 1971, they ultimately repriced it and said, now it's whatever the heck we want it to be, you know? And now it has nothing to do with their money. And that there was this whole three-card money and they switched out. And now we just have the pieces of paper and we can't get any gold for it at all. So I think, you know, in trying to figure out who did it, well, it was just the person that was in power each time was always trying to figure out the lesser of you know, the least bad option. But it was always least bad from a short-term perspective, because doing the long-term perspective thing is really bad in the short term, as what we saw in 1929, which was hyperdeflation, right? That is the most scary thing to these people in power. And this is I think maybe this will give you a little more perspective. I've mentioned this before, but there was a TV, I don't know, some TV special about 2008. And it was really interesting they interviewed, I think it was, what's his name? Hank Paulson. That was, he was in charge at the time. And he looks in the camera and he's like, you know, I was in my office after this stuff started going down and I just vomited up everywhere. And like, it's right into the trash can. And I was so embarrassed try to put yourself in his position. Here are your options. What are you going to do, Cedric? Right? Like it is effed up no matter how you look at it.
But I have put myself in his position.
Yeah.
I really tried to do that through that period. And, you know, you look at the decisions that were made and those decisions that Hank, you know, threw up over benefited all his friends big time. I mean, like he protected his wealth and legacy hardcore by protecting Goldman Sachs and related entities. And I think that's why he maybe puked in the trash bin. And I don't think it was out of the struggle of I want to, do the best thing for the world. And, you know, I just don't buy that. And, you know, I think a couple of things come up for me still that I want to kind of hammer, even if it's repetitive, but it's like, so back to the coin clipping, you know, and I'm wondering in that moment, you know, on the other side, the recipients of the coins that are getting clipped, because they're not getting clipped in a way that are seen. They're getting clipped in a devious, insidious way, I think, as you mentioned, you know, it's fake metal in there, or fake gold to, you know, kind of look like gold. And I'm wondering, do they intrinsically know they're getting robbed in that moment and have no choice? And I think, you know, probably I'm guessing the majority don't know. Right. And that they're getting robbed. But I do see all these clues throughout history that some people know. You know, I mean, you could see it a lot more, you know, starting with Austrian economics. You look at Rothbard and Mises, you know, and Hayek, and these people are getting it. And I look at even like a song like Marvin Gaye, Inner City Blues, you know, 1971, he's singing about it. Mm-hmm. He's singing about inflation. And now I look, you know, and I think broad picture again. So, you know, as societies and civilizations move to gold and silver, not everyone won that game long term. I've heard the notion. I don't know if it was in Dr. Safadine's book or maybe VJ's article, but you know, I don't know if this is true, but I've heard the notion that China and India fell behind by a century or two because they didn't move to gold as fast or as quickly as other societies did. And here we are where, you know, I see two things coming out of the next 100, 200 years. It's CBDCs. So that's digital coin clipping to me. And you have central bank, you know, monetary colonialism with the digital yuan, you know, and the Silk and Belt Road in China and these kinds of things. And we're looking at, America's looking at what to do. You know, my money's digital from the sense of like, I got PayPal, but you know, they're looking to roll out things and trying to compete politically with their money and build the network effects of that money, of the US dollar. And now you got Bitcoin. And we got 100 to 200 year decision, you know, and, you know, so these levers that are being pulled now have massive impact. So, you know, before we jump to now, let's jump a little bit to, you know, maybe United States central banking history. Because I think there was a lot of, you know, I mean, you have the play Hamilton, and then you have a lot of panics in the 19th century. Maybe you could kind of walk us through a little bit of what's going on with private money and specie and some of the times where we did have bank holidays, I guess, as you would call it, and heavily armed clown refer to it.
Right. So my understanding of this period in history is really the failure of all of the different types of monies that we had at the time. You know, we talk about gold as being the best money that we've had for 5,000 years. And I think that's true. There wasn't really much else that was better. And throughout American early history, there were a lot of experiments with paper money because gold was kind of failing to scale as a medium of exchange. It wasn't as portable, and its lack of portability gave way just enough for fiat to kind of emerge in these little pockets. And what would happen, you know, there's the whole story of the greenbacks, but there was many paper monies that kind of failed. And you're talking about private monies, you're talking about government monies as well. And there was a number of different attempts to institute, you know, national banks in the United States. And basically, when a modern Keynesian economic historians will point to these periods of time, they'll point to the failure of gold as a money. And it's funny because I agree with them, but for very different reasons. Mm. They'll tell you that it was the limited supply of gold that failed us as a society, that because we couldn't inflate, right? And that was the problem, because you know, they'll point to 1929. They'll probably point to all those, you know, bank failures and all these other issues. But my understanding is that it was gold's failure of a portability standpoint that gave rise to paper, right? The problem with 1929 wasn't that we were printing gold. You can't print gold. We were printing paper. And what happened was in the 1920s, we were printing it. And in 1929, things came back to reality. They simply returned to the baseline. And that return was sudden. And it was hyperdeflationary, and the economic calculations of these folks that for the last 10 years was, oh, inflation, and they all had debt. And then, you know, the system comes crashing down and the water goes out and you find out who doesn't have the shorts on. It was this paper gold dynamic that is the story of all of these failures and all these other things. Because if they were just literally transacting with the gold, well, then all you have is debt, right? And the debt is the only thing that is an expansionary monetary force, and that can come back. And then you just, the debtors, you know, they can not be repaid or whatever. The bank holidays was a way to kind of perpetuate these systems again. And it's the same story, or, you know, all these bank holidays avoid, you know, short-term pain, they kind of just keep kicking the can down the road. And there's these kind of echoes of this throughout American history. Does that help?
I'm really curious your thoughts on Keynes, your critique of Keynes, the positive and negative. You know, you mentioned that he says inflation is bad and that it debauches society. And from what I've heard, you know, he led a debaucherous lifestyle. But, you know, was he, you know, a genius who understood money and came up with some, you know, valuable principles about how to manage inflation? And at the time, we didn't have something like Bitcoin. Or was he, you know, someone who was, you know, really a high time preference thinker, and it was just really, you know, kind of maybe cleverly understood the tools of the day? Forgive me, I don't want to put words in your mouth. I mean, what do you think of Keynes and today?
Well, no, so I don't want to be, I don't want to misspeak here. I like throwing the Keynesianism back in their face. I think he kind of wrote later and changed his tune and said, oh, well, now, you know, now that we have government money, we got to, you know, we got to inflate and we got to step in interventions and all these things. I don't study Keynes, and I think most of his ideas are propaganda to make it more palatable to support inflationary inflationist and interventionist policies. And whether that benefited him or not, whether he, you know, was dishonest and did this from a standpoint of, you know, literally generating propaganda, or if he really believed his own BS, I have no idea. I never met the guy, and I don't really care to. But when you read Austrian economics, you understand the network of fallacies that are required in order to, you know, subscribe to these theories, because it doesn't account for the unseen. What's so frustrating to me when you hear a Keynesian talk about inflation and why it's necessary, and they're like, well, but if the wages are rising along with inflation, right? Oh, well, the wages are rising, so everything's good. Well, what about with the savings, right? The savings are still debased by inflation. And the biggest problem with inflation today is it's the asset inflation. So you get people that are holding money, their savings are debased. If they're lucky, and I think most Americans aren't, their wages are barely keeping up with inflation. And the people that are hold assets are becoming wealthier and wealthier. And I have nothing wrong with people becoming wealthy, but it seems like the system is unfair, because the poor, you know, the poorest people in our society can't hold assets, right? They can't. They need the liquid money. So it's all BS. Anything that is defending inflation fails to see this horrible broken system that keeps the people that are on the bottom down, and it supports the people on the top. So it's completely backwards.
Right. If, you know, maybe I can make this the argument that if centralization of gold was kind of like the first war, and then the centralization of fiat, or, you know, central banking in 1913 is like the second war, you know, is CBDCs like the third war. And, you know, we've been battling, let's say, you know, centralization of money and this sort of these negative externalities from central banking since 1913 in ways that have been extremely hard to fight back against. I mean, in 1933, you know, your best weapon against that form of oppression and violence was gold, and they made it illegal in the freest nation in the world.
Well, and it was, that was a kind of a bait and switch too, right? Because, you know, we made the gold illegal, but you can have these pieces of paper instead, and they're worth the same as the gold, right? So you don't lose anything, right? And the way they pulled that off was because nobody held the gold. Nobody had the gold. It was all in the bank vaults, right? There's a few people that, you know, had some buried in their backyard or in a safe or something. But in order to pull that off, you know, it had to already be centralized. So the hope with Bitcoin is that people actually hold it themselves. And, you know, at least this year we've seen some of the Bitcoin coming off of exchanges and stuff. But the CBDC thing, you keep bringing it up. And, man, it's kind of a funny one, because, I mean, oh, we're going to make this CBDC that competes with Bitcoin. Really? So is it going to be censorship resistant, hard cap supplies? So
I don't think it competes with Bitcoin at all.
Right.
I think it competes with the commercial banks.
But the angle you're taking is, well, yeah, well, it is the central banks, right? That's what
commercial banks. It's central banks versus commercial banks. And, well, and they're going to control the rails from A to Z.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And I think that it's a way to export power and oppression abroad. And I think that there could be a scenario where Bitcoin could be astronomical prices. Doesn't mean that it's widely, and when I say widely distributed, it could be more widely distributed than fiat, but that doesn't mean that it's widely distributed and used per se. Okay. It could just have a lot of value. People who have the most money might accumulate the most Bitcoin, even though it's more decentralized and distributed than fiat. And I don't know how long that battle plays out before Bitcoin, let's say, wins.
Right.
You know, is it 150 years and we got 80 years of CBDC digital slavery? That's a new machination the world has never seen before.
Well, I think it will be interesting to watch the central banks try to develop plans for CBDCs and decide what kinds of properties they want and what types of technology they'll use for them. Will they be, you know, centralized, completely centralized, where, you know, it's not a bearer asset in any way, or will, you know, because
I agree, it won't be.
It, right.
It so won't like, have any positive properties. I'm not arguing it won't have any positive properties, but most of the people might not notice any of that. They're not like, you know, it's interesting. We bring up Keynesians and I don't want to learn much about Keynes, but you know, there is this, every Austrian I've ever met who's well-versed in Austrian economics is probably better versed in Keynesian economics than Keynesian economists.
But ask yourself this, right? So what would the properties be of this hypothetical central bank digital currency? Supposedly the yuan they're already starting to do it, right? But I haven't seen one of these and I haven't read the white paper
the core competency is the instrument of debt. So now the recipient owes the distributor.
Here, listen for a second. The goal of probably anybody creating a new money, and I do mean nation states in this day and age, because we know there's like a fervor to kind of unseat the US dollar. China wants it, Russia wants it. Probably a lot of countries want the US to not longer be monetary hegemon in the world. So in theory, the central banks are trying to compete with each other in a way. And who's gonna get to hold the keys to the central bank digital currency, and what features are they gonna allow in order to do that, right? So one version of a central bank digital currency I can see is like the Fed, right? Let's say the Fed is like, oh, well, without a social security number and KYC, you can't have any of this, right? So how is somebody in Malaysia or whatever gonna be able to adopt the US central bank Fed coin, right? So how portable is it? How open is it for other countries to use? And how will that system work? You're talking about, disintermediating the commercial banks. Well, the commercial banks are what allow, through the euro dollar system, allow your dollars to spread globally, right? So how does it work, right? And how, once you start getting money digital, and let's say even these things proliferate a little bit, I think it gets easier and easier. I mean, and this is the other thing I don't understand, is that all the fiat's already digital, dude. It's already 80-90% digital. So what's the difference, right? Well, Show me how it's different. I know that they'll be able to add and subtract balances from you and do all this like awesome government manipulation. Two main differences.
I think that, you know, it is central bank versus central bank. And if you look at, you know, I think it's the biggest central banks are gonna win. Only one of those biggest players now have a chance, I believe, is at winning. So, network effects.
Because network effects, right.
Right. So, you know, and I also think that, you know, that these, there's no benefits to the recipients. There's only negatives, but there's a lot of benefits to the winner of that race. You know, it's a form of warfare. And it's, I believe the winner of that race gets to export surveillance technology to the most destinations. Mm-hmm. And if you can surveil your own population successfully, which I don't think is a fiat complete, I'm not certain that this Communist Party would be able to pull that off successfully. But if they could, and then use surveillance technology and that debt instrument to export colonialism. You know, could you imagine if, you know, Mexico only, you know, accepted the digital yuan? That doesn't mean it's a benefit to Mexicans or to Americans. It just means that it's harder for you and I to do business in Mexico now, you know, or to use our own money there. And I think that's power.
What I love about Bitcoin is that the harder they push on these things, right? Let's say, you know, let's say Fedcoin proliferates and it's the best central bank digital currency, or Russia coin or whatever, China yuan, digital yuan. Right. Let's say one of these actually start to proliferate, and then they start, they start doing inflation. Well, then you have Bitcoin, right? They start, putting lots of capital controls on it. You can't take it out of the country. You can't buy this with it. Oh, there's still Bitcoin, right? So the harder they push, the more attractive an option Bitcoin becomes. And I think what you alluded to earlier is that the fear of Bitcoiners is that they can regulate at the edges, right? They can't regulate Bitcoin itself. They can't really stop it either. But what they can do is regulate the edges. But isn't the whole idea of central bank digital currencies making them more portable and more accessible to more people so that they can
become
the new hegemon?
Yeah.
So it's like these competing forces that I don't see how it competes at all.
Oh, I believe it's the more likely scenario that CBDCs just bring more proliferation of knowledge to things like Bitcoin specific. And I think Bitcoin is the winner of that at the end of the day, period. I'm just looking at all scenarios and just trying to even dig at some worst case ones, because this obviously hasn't been an easy battle. And Bitcoin's only been around 11 years. So we've only had this opportunity for 11 years to fight back with this tool. And I believe in this tool more than anything, but there's no but there, but I'm curious about the power of states and how that power is going to turn as, we get new tools, they get new tools. Mm-hmm. Things like UBI, it's just such an interesting thing here to me, how those things get seeded, those ideas through politicians. I wonder where these politicians come from, who financially backs their campaigns, who's pushing that idea, in my opinion. Why are those ideas seeded with a candidate who probably has no chance of winning? It's obviously messaging. And in my mind, in that case, these candidates who have no chance of winning, they're just bringing messages to the table. It's amazing to me that UBI went from, a candidate on the margin to a very prominent topic. And it seems to be coming on very quickly. And I think that's another tool to get more connection between the state and the individual with directly through money. It just cuts banks out directly. Mm-hmm. And makes their value prop go to zero. But it further centralized control and maybe that battle.
What does UBI do, right?
It destroys the whole value of money. I get that part too.
Or it's redistributive, right?
Which is
also destroying the value of money. So you have the wealthy, right, who you're talking about being in power and what they want, right? And so you're either using UBI to redistribute wealth away from them to poor people, right? Because that's what UBI does. Because if you give everybody $1,000, well, the poor person kind of wins a whole lot more than the person with $1 billion, right? You give a billionaire $1,000, doesn't do anything. And that's what UBI is. It's redistributive. And the reason that we have a clamor for UBI today is because of increasing automation, which should be bringing deflation, right? You keep playing this out to its logical extreme. You have wealthy people that hold assets, and there's redistribution of wealth, and they're kind of losing it from every side there. I think the more you do it, and it also, I think it is inflationary, right? Because even if you're not printing money, but you're taking it from people who generally don't spend a lot, right? They hold a larger portion of their wealth, and they only spend smaller proportions of it. You're redistributing away from them to people that really need to spend the money on all sorts of things. And that still creates inflation, even if you're not, price inflation, even if you're not increasing the money supply. And then again, here's Bitcoin. And it's, for a wealthy individual that's trying to stop all these people from trying to take all his wealth, it's like, well, man, why don't I just put some into Bitcoin, right? And that's the great thing about good money, is that the incentives are aligned for everybody to adopt this stuff. I think the assets are overvalued, and I think they know that. And, there aren't a lot of opportunities for yield, and, the VC industry there's no discipline, and everything's overcrowded, and there's only really one thing that has the potential to go up a whole lot and to offer return. And some really, really wealthy people this year are starting to see that. And that's when you run into the principal agent problem, where if the people in power start to benefit from Bitcoin, well, then what do they want, right? So I can see a lot of different sides of this, and obviously I don't know the future either, but that's the side that I see that seems more likely, is that everybody wants yield, man. And
yeah. What stuck in my claw is, you know, I had this conversation with Jeff Andrew about distributism, and he sees, and I think I see it too, is that UBI is a billionaire capitalist policy, because they need to support their workers and their consumers. There has to be money for them to spend on the products that they're and services that they are trying to sell. And there's this circular, kind of logic where you got to make sure that they don't rebel. They don't rebel and they don't go completely broke, and you have the let them eat cake moment.
Right.
So it's kind of like where these kind of, you go through these transitions where, you know, billionaires, philanthropists and rich people who tried to do it through charity. Charity wasn't doing it. Then it was kind of like the welfare state. So, you know, we moved to a welfare state, and they're trying to keep the system going. They're trying to get money into their pockets. They got to redistribute small amounts. And that's not taking us far enough in this inflationary environment. So UBI is sort of the next step where, you know, the powers, the billionaires are pushing the state to redistribute small amounts of money so that the system doesn't crumble now. And that it just keeps, and I'm not saying that's a good thing or a bad thing. It's why I go at this angle of, like, I'm not so sure billionaires are against UBI. They might be the people behind it. And I don't know if they even understand the principles. So just really, and you were talking before, and it's like, you know, about the 1920s and this decade. And I think we're heading into, like, more like the 1930s.
Right. Well, that's what I'm saying, is we've been in the 20s already, right?
Right.
We're ahead of the, we're ahead by 10 years or something. And I agree, but I think Jeff and I, you know, I've discussed with Jeff, and Jeff is very, very intelligent. I respect him a lot. But I do kind of disagree with him on part of this here, where the reason we quote need UBI today, and I acknowledge that we do quote need it, is because of inflation. So if you look at the last 100, 200, 300 years, you can keep going back. Why is our standard of living better? Why is it better? And ask anybody, look around your house. Why is your standard of living better? Look at your life itself. How do you get around? Cars? We use technology. Every single thing in your house has benefited from technology. What does technology do? Jeff Booth will tell you that it's deflation, right? Technology brings deflation by increasing productivity and reducing the cost of these things and making them more available to us. That objectively, society is better off by the amount of tools that we have, and really the cost of those tools as a result of deflation. And much in spite of this deflationary force, remember, these forces are competing and they're all kind of pushing and pulling us in different directions. Much in spite of the deflation of technology, which has been going for hundreds of years, there is inflationary money. And that is kind of limiting the amount that society itself can benefit from deflation, from technological progress, from the very thing that every single firm on the corners, the street corner, is trying to do, which is compete with their neighbor, to reduce the cost of something, to do it quicker and faster and better for less money, so that they can get your business, so that they can decrease the cost of these things for consumers and society itself. And we have been doing everything in our power for the last 50 years to make sure that that doesn't happen, and happens in a negative way at 2% per year, according to some basket of goods. So if you entertain this for a moment and say, well, what if we just had a fixed supply money? Just hypothetically speaking, right? If we had a fixed supply money, then we would continue using all these technological progress to decrease costs, and it would be happening much quicker. And as we use an automation, like, you know, replacing all of the drivers on the road with that includes 10 million truck drivers, right? And replacing people in factories, which has already been happening for the last 20 years. Well, then when you lose your job doing that, your savings over the last 20 years as you were losing your job should be going up in value, okay? So remember the difference between getting your wages to keep pace with inflation and your savings to keep pace with inflation. Well, this solves both problems, because now your savings are getting more valuable each year because there's more goods with the same amount of savings you can buy. And your wages, you don't have to fight for a raise at all. Shit, you can make the same money every single year and be able to buy more stuff with it, right? You don't have to fight with the guy. And then maybe if you do really well, then maybe he'll give you a raise, right? So now do you still think society needs a UBI? Cedric, ask yourself, do you think we really need a UBI?
No,
the cost of everything is falling so fast and accelerating, right? Jeff Boo talks about how it is accelerating exponentially, and it should be, but we are doing everything to prevent that. Why don't we just fucking stop printing money? Well, maybe society can start to actually progress.
Yeah, I agree. I'm not for UBI. I'm against UBI. I'm against money printing. maybe 10 years ago when I first heard UBI, I was really enamored with the idea and I was trying to get my head around it. And, you don't know everything at once at all in your life. And I was looking at it and I was trying to get my head around the idea that you could, jobs are, because I'll stipulate that, and I'll argue that there's 5 million jobs in this country that are zombie jobs. Mm-hmm. We have zombie companies.
Yep.
We have zombie 401k plans where people just dump money in them weekly and bi-weekly without looking at prices. You would never go to the supermarket and pick up a tomato and be like, oh, this week it's 10 bucks and for 10 tomatoes. And next week it's 100 bucks for 10 tomatoes. Yep, kids love tomatoes. Like, you'd be like, maybe they're going to get more cucumbers this week, you know, but not in your 401k plan, right? You're going to buy the S&P 500 every week, regardless of price. And I think, that's sort of the monetization of stocks. And I'm curious about what you think about monetization of all these things in like the 20th, now the 21st century, like maybe like things like IPOs.
Oh, well, this is another one of these inflationist propaganda things that where they're like, oh, well, no. So if we didn't have inflation, man, people would hoard money. Oh, That's terrifying, right? People would hoard money. Wait, do you mean save money? Is that what you're talking about?
They put a negative word on it.
Because the paradigm today is that people are hoarding assets, which is far, far worse. I mean, the fact that, 20% of, or I think it's 10% of New York real estate sits vacant, the most bustling city in the whole world.
It distorts that housing market, yeah.
As a store of value, and the assets, the stocks, as a store of value, right? So when you're buying the S&P 500, are you buying it because you think those companies are going to do better and you want to capitalize those companies more? No, you just told me that they're all zombies, but you're buying it anyway because that's what everyone else does, right? This is the monetization of stocks.
And they get to keep their jobs too. It's circular. Like, if they turn off the buying, then the job does go away. And these people, like, they're so, I call them like the walking, retirees. They're just waiting to retirement day. They're, and you have less and less of it in the younger generations, people staying at a company for 20, 30 years. But you could go through any company in the Fortune 2000 and gut jobs. And I don't mean that in a harmful way to the people who have those jobs, but those companies would still turn on the lights the next day and deliver those products and probably would be forced to invest in newer technology instead of staying on their antiquated systems that become manual breakouts in the back office. But if they fire 1,000 people and you're not forced into your 401k through tax incentives, like it does crumble a lot quicker. And a lot of people like going to those jobs and not doing anything all day.
Well,
that was the thought. My thought back then, I was like, yeah, put them all on UBI. Let them be poets, but I don't think that's a solution. I think that's all just more fake, nonsensical band-aids when you get serious about it. But, I really have concern that things can go on in a long perpetuity as is. Even, and I worry about this in a worst case scenario, but, because I don't know if people are turning to Bitcoin in mass, but the S&P 500 is starting to, with the micro strategies and the domino effect that's going to have. And they're going to be the ones borrowing tons of money for 0, 1% or 2% interest from Wall Street bondholders, from central banks, commercial banks, whatever machinations they get involved with, to acquire and stock, Bitcoin on their balance sheets for their shareholders, which again is a very you know, concentrated wealth of or concentrated position of ownership.
Yeah,
the next wave is not retail. You know, that's why, you know, maybe aside from a little couple things on CNBC, you know, mainstream media is not talking about Bitcoin. They're not telling the people right now, like, go stock up, save for your future. That's not happening. Everyone I know is talking about COVID and how hard it is out there, and jobs that, you know, most of these jobs, like, you could argue a lot of these jobs we don't have right now are never coming back and not as needed, you know, unless you're talking about the service industry. And, you know, I'd love for the, you know, bars and restaurants to open again and for people to be able to congregate and get together. I'm not arguing against those kinds of jobs and things of that nature. And I'm not trying to say my thoughts on jobs are well thought out, but there's a lot of jobs that are not needed. And I think that COVID, for whatever reason, accelerated our pushed into the future. And it's doing things like my local pizza place is going out of business, but Pizza Hut is staying up because they get a loan. They don't have as good a pizza as Pizza Hut, but I'm going to wake up in 2 years and go down Main Street, and there's not going to be a local pizza place, but there'll be a Domino's, a Pizza Hut, Papa John's. No excuse to pomp. I know he loves Domino's, but I really worry about that. And and not to get too negative, I guess, you know, but like, what do you think of 2020? And I mean, you and Heavily Armed Clown have been kind of calling these things for a while. Yeah. Maybe, you know, you didn't know what that a pandemic was going to come, but you knew a Black Swan event was coming.
Yeah. And I mean, he recently, I think this week, he tweeted out something about him calling the, you know, the next kind of financial money printing event. And it was, you know, a year or two ago. And obviously we didn't call the pandemic itself. But the other thing that we were talking about around that same time was what you alluded to, which is, well, what if they just keep kicking the can down the road, right? And what does that look like? Well, we have this nice little case study, which, and I realize that some of the factors are different, and, you know, in every single country, but we have this little case study of Japan, who what I say is they're kind of ahead on the road of the fiat endgame, where we just found that now Japan is like the number one stockholder, the Bank of Japan. I'm sorry, the Central Bank of Japan now owns the majority of stocks.
80%, yeah.
And that wasn't the case a few years ago, but they were kind of heading down. They were like a top 10 in like the top 500 companies or something. Now they're the majority shareholder. So what is that? And that's essentially the government owning the means of production. It is the slow slip into communism. And we know that communism doesn't work. So you want to keep kicking this can down the road, Mr. Regulator, feel free to, but you're heading us down a path where we are losing the benefits of capitalism. We are losing the free markets, and we are getting more and more centralized, and we're destroying price discovery, which is the most important function to understand, that prices are emergent on a market. And the more that we disrupt these prices, that's the whole disrupting entrepreneurs and borrowers and savers, is that we've disrupted the mechanism by which we calculate economically, by destroying price discovery at all, right? I mean, you know, the stock market went up in 2020. It shouldn't have gone up. It should have gone down. We should have taken our money out of stocks and put it into cash, which is what you use to hedge against uncertainty. And this has been in the most uncertain year in potentially 100 years, you know? We should all be in cash, but why we aren't is because of the distortions in the markets themselves. So the more they do this, the more they're gonna get more unrest and more zombies and more people with mental disorders that they can't figure out. I mean, if you were a millennial today, I mean, you look at the future and you're like, well, there's no hope. There's no opportunity here. I'm never going to be able to retire. I can't even afford a house. You know, that's terrifying. So, I mean, the system needs to heal itself. I think the only antidote is sound money. And maybe we won't be, these prognosticators and people just listen to us. But the great thing about sound money is that it has a little incentive to hold it because of a little thing we like to call NGU technology, mm-hmm. right? So the more they print, the harder they push the more difficult they make it to move around any whatever central bank digital currency or digital fiat or whatever it is, the more attractive Bitcoin comes. And you said, I don't know if people are using it en masse. Well, you know, maybe not in the Western world, but we need it the least. If you look at third world countries, I mean, I just retweeted a thread from Alex Gladstein about people using it in Africa and in Asia and all these places where money is so broken, right? I mean, do you think that the Fed rolling out central bank digital currencies are going to serve people in remote places in Africa and Central Asia and in South America? I don't. I know what is serving those people right now today in Venezuela, in Argentina, and in Sudan and all these places, and Nigeria. Bitcoin is serving them right now today. And it's not necessarily serving them even as a store of value. It's working as a medium exchange for these people, right? For some of them. So, I mean, the worse that your money is, the easier it is to kind of see how Bitcoin just routes around all that mess. I mean, evil of central banking.
Yeah. I mean, my internal core is tremendously optimistic, but I'm always trying to look at the most pessimistic scenarios to be on guard.
Sure.
And to battle test my ideas. You know, I want to turn back to gold. And I agree, gold failed and it's not going to work as money going forward. But let's stipulate that, or let's try to create a world where none of that matters and that gold's working beautifully and there is no fiat. And we don't have any issues that we get with central banking, just in this little, you know, kind of small box experiment. Mm-hmm. So now, but we do have like natural inflation of gold. Mm-hmm. Right. Well, there's just a little bit more gold coming out of the earth. Yeah. The more valuable it gets, the more expensive machines we can turn on. We can get a little bit more out. And I'm not getting into like the oceans and the atmosphere. Just let's say that the world order was on hard money, it was gold, and that you just had this natural, and gold is a beautiful thing where it was kind of evenly distributed throughout the earth. So maybe, you know, someone gets a gold pile, you know, a state or a country or people come across a big batch of gold one decade or every 100 years, but it's evenly distributed over time. What is your take then, or your feelings on inflation in that kind of weird little thought bubble world? Is it okay? Is it good?
I mean, we have 3,000 or 4,000 years of history that pretty closely models what you're talking about. Where if you look at, you know, the CPI chart, this is one of the CPI charts on WTF happened in 1971. It's CPI since 1800 or something like that. And you can see that it kind of just lays flat, right? There was like almost just enough inflation to kind of keep prices flat for a few hundred years. And I still think inflation is not ideal. I think harder money is still more ideal.
Yeah, I agree.
But that's better than what we have today. And if we had that, we would have a sounder society. We'd have less debt. We'd have more savings. We'd have less zombies. We'd have, we wouldn't have negative interest rates, for example. I mean, they wouldn't be viable. You can't do them, right? You wouldn't be able to have massive bailouts. You wouldn't. So the world would be better. And it's still possible that Bitcoin emerges in that world because a harder money is still even better. Even if you're saying that the portability of gold isn't a problem and Bitcoin doesn't compete there, well, Bitcoin still competes on other metrics like, you know, censorship resistance and seizure resistance and these other things. Yeah. So, I mean, I still see that Bitcoin is an evolution of money and that, you know, fiat tried to be the successor to gold. And they've done surprisingly well as far as keeping the game going for as long as they have, but they've pushed so hard and they've kind of overplayed their hand that the emergence of Bitcoin was kind of inevitable, that the ingenuity of man has kind of solved this problem for society. That's my take on it.
Yeah. When did you start looking at, you know, money and economics, maybe even more specifically Austrianomics, but what kind of brought you down that rabbit hole?
Yeah, so I knew about Bitcoin in 2011, 2012, 2013, even tried to get some around then. But I understood that it was like an anonymous money. That's what I thought it, you know, that was the whole point. I didn't understand monetary economics and all these things, or that the price could go up and down or whatever. The price had not even emerged since 2011. But regardless, I was like, oh, it's an anonymous money. I get that. You could buy drugs on the internet with it. I understand that. And I tried to get some, and they wanted like my bank details. And I was like, well, that's not anonymous. And I kind of forgot about it for a few years, to be honest with you. You could see it come up on like a TV show or something like that. But in 2017, when the price went up so high, that was when I started getting interested in trying to understand it. And I eventually found Andreas' videos, and he has a good way of kind of describing how it helps, you know, all those people like I was talking about in Sudan and Nigeria and Venezuela and all these things. And then I started getting into it. I'm like, dude, wow, this Bitcoin thing's pretty cool. I started arguing with people, and I started, I remember specifically there was one guy that really pushed me over the edge that realized that I didn't know what I was talking about. And he is a guy that worked, in the financial, in basically the Wall Street of Europe during the 2008 financial crisis. And he had a pretty good understanding of economics, and I didn't. And I was on Reddit at the time, which if you're on Reddit still, I'm sorry. Get on Twitter. And that was what people on Reddit were saying. It was like, just get off Reddit. It's not even good for Bitcoin content. And who was the guy that they recommended that I follow? Well, it was this guy named Pierre Rochard. I don't know if you've heard of him. Mm-hmm. And so I was like, I followed him, and he had this podcast, and I started listening to him talk about Austrian economics. And I was like, okay, economics, I have to learn that. And eventually, I found this book club with a few great guys. Justin Moon started, and that was when I started discussing Austrian economics with people like Max Hillebrand, and really diving down the rabbit hole of real economics, which is based on logic and deduction and first principles thinking. And that led us to, you know, even farther to try to understand money. And obviously I eventually read Safe's book, and he goes over the history of money. And I eventually read Nick Szabo's Shelling Out. And if you use these two tools together to understand the emergent nature of money, and then use Austrian economics as a logic to support your understanding of how different types of money affect society, that was the path I took.
Yeah. I think Bitcoin, you know, offers a lot of rabbit holes. Even with just directly within Bitcoin, you know, it's not one big rabbit hole. Austrian economics, technology, coding. I mean, Justin Moon does a lot with coding and programming, I think. So is it fair to say that you weren't you didn't study economics in college or high school? That wasn't your bag until Bitcoin?
Yes.
And then and was economics then the thing that kind of grabbed you first, or not grabbed you first, but like the first or your favorite rabbit hole at first?
Yes. My favorite rabbit hole was helping Bitcoin help society, right? Mm. And that I've explored through a number of different ways. But once I started reading Austrian economics, and I realized it was all based on logic and critical thinking and thinking from first principles, I realized that this, you know, where has this been all my life? And I feel like it answered a lot of the unanswered questions about the world. And if you listen to a lot of Bitcoin podcasts of like random plebs like me that they let on, a lot of them will say, you know, I didn't really feel like, I felt like the world wasn't working for people, but I didn't really understand why. It was Austrian economics, not Bitcoin, that allowed me to understand what was really wrong with the world, that despite all of these progress, all this stuff that we were talking about earlier, that we have all this cool technology, you know, in general, you could buy a better computer and a better iPhone and a better dishwasher even every year and a better car for approximately the same amount of money, that was getting better every year, but why is society getting worse? It didn't make sense to me until I understood Austrian economics and inflation and deflation and all these things that to the average person, they're just like, oh, inflation equals good. That's what they told me in high school. That was what allowed me to really be a Bitcoin bull and understand from an economic and a monetary perspective that this technology will propel us into the future.
Yeah. I mean, I could really relate to you maybe coming across Bitcoin before 2017 and not getting any of the, you know, store of value, savings, Austrian economics principles. It just seemed like the most exciting thing I'd heard about in a long time that was going to help a lot of people who needed whatever problems it was going to solve, whether it was anonymity or just being able to transact. You know, there was nothing that I needed to transact. You know, I didn't need to get into a new circular economy per se, but it just sounded so cool. But not from I was like, I want to use it. I don't necessarily want to own it and hold it. Oil is really great. It moves my car around. I don't want to buy it and put it in my backyard. but like, you know, when did you kind of zero in on 1971? And what maybe is your connection to Heavily Armed Clown? Did you guys, have you ever met in real life? Did you meet through Bitcoin on Twitter?
Yeah, it's on our list actually. So there's a few questions in there. The first question was, the second question is how did I meet Armstrong? The first question is, you better answer the second question first. I met Heavily Armed Clown because I was just listening to a bunch of different podcasts, and for whatever reason, his came across my desk, and I was listening to a few. And at the end of his podcast, and you'll hear a lot of podcasters say stuff like this: "My DMs are open. Hit me up if you ever want to have a chat." And he did, and I did, and we kind of got on a quick call, and we had a chat, and we were like, "Hey, you want to maybe try to do an episode?" And I worked up the idea to do the Bitcoin spectrum and understanding Bitcoin from these different this kind of Venn diagram of different things, from cryptography to economics to politics to, and how these things all overlap, and that you need a relatively solid understanding of each one of these things. You need a baseline understanding each one of these things to evaluate whether or not Bitcoin is a viable money. But then he and I became kind of friends afterward, and I started really going more down the economics and the monetary rabbit hole. You asked about, you know, me understanding, my desire to understand the history of money. And that led me to, obviously, to 1913, and then to 1929 and 1933, and then to 1971. And when I got to the 1971 thing, I got onto the Bretton Woods page and the Nixon shock. And a few of those charts that are near the top of the website came from those Wikipedia pages. And I was like, wow, I mean, this is pretty amazing. We went off the gold standing, and like, look at these charts. This is awful, right? Like, look, it says, and we started like finding more and more of them. And we would start arguing with people on the internet about how going off the gold standard was not a good thing, because I think this, you understand that inflation started and the society got worse. And then I wrote that thread that you talked about where, you know, inflation was the greatest problems that society faces today. The rising costs of healthcare and housing and education are what we talk about when you see that. You know, that is the debates between these presidents, right? Is healthcare and education and housing, right? I mean, these are the real problems of society. And we started amassing a number of these different charts. And I think it was this guy named Malik. I don't know if you follow him on Twitter. I think he's Armenian. Or something like, if he's listening right now, I apologize if I'm butchering this part of the story. But Malik, he on some Pierre Richard thread, he was like, I think he actually said WTF happened, or what happened in 1971. And it kind of got Colin and I thinking, and Colin had the idea. It's like, let's just throw this stuff on a website so that we don't have to keep, like, we were like in our phones, like trying to like find these charts over and over again to like post to people. It'd be like, listen, you don't even know what I'm talking about. And that was kind of how the meme was born.
So somewhere before that, you guys are just, you're digging at charts, right?
Mm-hmm.
Just in your own free time, just trying to figure this thing out.
Yeah, we're monetary nerds, man.
Yeah, it's so wild. I mean, I love it. And I can't speak to how powerful that meme is. And I feel like I got to watch some of it in real time in terms of like you guys kind of seeding it and talking about it. And it was very... You know, it was just really striking. It really pulled me aside, and it was hard to cross-reference where the meme came from. And I think that's what you guys did really well, because a lot of where I came across it was through Heavily Armed Clown's account, which to me, with his profile picture and combined with his ideas and how he speaks about economics, it just really cut through a lot of noise. And you guys would seed the meme and the website. And I didn't know if he was like kind of like a Twitter fanboy. That's kind of how I read it. It's like he's, you know, because like I didn't know he's behind the website because it's not on his Twitter profile. And you would think that if you founded this amazing website, it would be on your Twitter profile. So it was hard to connect dots, which I think is a better way to do it because it allows the idea to speak for itself.
Right. And the meme itself has been kind of an emergent thing. We just threw these charts up on a website that we'd have to stop, you know, pawing through our photos on Twitter. So when we wanted to post them, and then we could just like, oh, go to the website, right? WTF happened. And yep. We figured it would make our arguments and our debates more efficient. Right.
And I like how you guys didn't answer it.
Right. Yes.
I love how you never answered it. And it was very frustrating, but that's powerful.
And now that we have the Twitter, I mean, we tried to like start arguing with people that would like push back on stuff on using the Twitter account. And we've realized that like, well, what if we just keep only asking them questions, right?
Right.
So instead of arguing with them and telling them why they're wrong, yeah. being like, well, what if this though, or how does inflation work, or you know what, and keeping the meme of question, making yeah. people kind of question for themselves.
That was probably the best and hardest part of my conversation with Hevelarum Clown was he wouldn't answer the question. Right. And like he kept making me answer the question in a way, but right. by making it rhetorical. And I think it's a very effective thing because it makes you have to make up your own mind, makes you have to come up with your own. And he allowed you as well, but really to make wrong conclusions, mm-hmm. you know, and to just answer it for yourself and let that conversation speak for itself was really effective. I appreciated it. And I think it's wild, you know, yeah, I'm guessing you guys have never really met in real life now. And you got this. Yeah. What was also interesting too, is I think also over time, it wasn't even maybe sponsored by River at first, which made it
right.
You know, then when it gets sponsored by River, it's like, I still don't know who's behind this thing. All of a sudden it's got a Bitcoin tinge to it.
So there's a minor correction in there. We have met in real life because Bitcoin Twitter okay. is real life.
Fair enough. Fair enough.
And when the meme started kind of getting a lot bigger than we thought it was going to get, it started getting shared on Reddit a lot and then on Twitter. And Eric Weinstein got interested and retweeted something that had mm-hmm. a link to it.
Right.
Which is hilarious because he's like kind of the whole case study for the meme where mm. people, like if you ask this question rhetorically and you don't provide the answer, people have all sorts of interesting, you know, reasons for it, like hippies and all the, you know, all these other things. It was labor unions and these things. And Eric Weinstein, who is brilliant, yeah. has a whole podcast about trying to explain all the things except the monetary angle of why WTF happened. It's hilarious.
When you guys were going back and forth with him, I really was hoping for a breakthrough there. I was listening to his podcast, but definitely in the beginning. I've moved away from it for a bit mm-hmm. for a couple of reasons. One, he seems to have that huge blind spot. I don't know how it didn't get through to him. The thing I wanted to mention about your website too, which I really enjoyed, was I came across my mind during my solidification of my conviction. Sort of the deepest, darkest part of the bear market is when I was grinding the hardest and doming the most pods, reading the most I could. And I was really probably at that point, you know, espousing publicly in my personal life more than, you know, from a very ecstatic, you know, kind of like revelationary kind of moment.
Yes.
And what I loved about that website is because I was probably putting too many Bitcoin standards in front of my coworkers and you know, too many articles and podcasts and things that were a little bit more than they can handle probably, or more than they wanted to get into. But then I was just like, I would email them the website or just bring them over to my desk and show them the website. And now I could do what you guys did and just said, ask me questions. Like, mm-hmm. what do you make of this?
Yeah.
I mean, every one of these charts is skyrocketing. And they're not all directly. That's what's interesting too, is I was just listening to Hevelarum Clown on, I think Total Bitcoin came out yesterday. And he was talking about like, and I love this too. It's like, not all of it's money. I mean, he was getting into how divorce rates skyrocket, but there were changes in the legal law around no fault divorce. Sure. And that's where I like how we're not going to answer the question for you because there's a lot going on here. Yeah, I just really, I'm really blown away by it. I'll turn to one more thing. I think you tweeted out about Assange and kind of hoping for pardon. How does that fit into your kind of view on maybe liberty and sovereignty, independence, freedom, truth, and being a Bitcoiner?
Assange in particular?
Or... Yeah, Assange in particular and or maybe his particular case. I don't know if that's something you want to speak to. But it's something I'm trying to get some clarity around.
Assange, like Bitcoin, and their histories are intertwined as well.
They are. I mean, he asked for donations at one point, and Satoshi was like, maybe that's not a good idea.
You're kicking the hornet's nest, I believe, was the term he used. But Assange is a result of the internet. His story is a result of the internet. The ability to crowdsource information about information and asymmetries and about abuses of power. And so Assange, like Bitcoin itself, are kind of responses to the oppression that people see in so many various forms throughout so many various nations. And they're also both born out of the digital age. And it's hilarious because the progress of society is technology, and technology bore the internet. Although some would argue that it was the government that invented the internet, I'm quite sure that no matter what, with the proliferation of computers, an internet of some kind would have been invented anyway, and probably on a free market, it'd be better, and it'd probably be more private, right? HTTP is kind of broken, but both of these things are responses to oppressive governments, and I think that governments have gotten so large and so oppressive because of broken money. Mm-hmm. You can go all the way back a few thousand years ago to the debasing of gold and coin clipping and all that. And you can fast forward back all the way to today where they can print, what was it, six, seven, I've lost count. How many $1 trillion did they print this year alone? Over 20% of the money supply. The technology has given them an opportunity to oppress us even harder. They can print more money at lower cost than they could back then. But the technology has also brought the technology is a double-edged sword, and it's brought us the tools to kind of resist these things. And certainly I think Assange should be pardoned. All he ever did was spread information, and I don't think information should ever be illegal. And especially if that information puts governments in a bad light, because I think governments do all sorts of terrible shit. And there's a whole reason we have body cams. Assange was the fucking body cam of the whole world. And I think that was a great thing. So I definitely support him, and I support seeing Edward Snowden, who is the same basic story, and Ross Ulbricht is in a similar vein there as well. And I definitely support him.
Yeah, it's very interesting cases. I definitely, I think Free Ross is just a no-brainer. The Snowden and Assange things, I'm still trying to understand. I definitely have sympathy and empathy for their cases, and they seem like freedom and truth fighters. I'm just still trying to learn more. It's not where I've put my energy, actually, to be honest, in terms of trying to study those cases. I appreciate you sharing. This has been incredibly, just so dope. I've enjoyed this so much. I definitely want to, give the floor to you if you have any parting words.
No, not really. I think, again, I always say my DMs are open, so feel free to reach out. I'm at MRCOOLBP. On Twitter, check out our website, WTFHappenedIn1971.com. You can check out, although we haven't been releasing many episodes recently, the Bitcoin Echo Chamber podcast.
Get back to it. Let's go.
We're trying. We got a lot going on.
Get some up, man. I have to say, it's probably my favorite intro music of any podcast, any Bitcoin podcast. I love it. It's really good. I can't wait till you guys start pumping out some pods. Yeah, I have noticed that the newsletter has been coming along, but that you've been putting out the newsletter. And I think that's really, maybe even, more important than the pod in some ways. So, maybe that's where the energy has been going, but I'd like to see both. I like hearing you guys talk. Pod out, and let's get some fresh intro music going. the same intro music, but some more eps in front of, behind it. But this has been so dope. Really, I really appreciate this, Ben.
Yeah, man. Thanks for having me on, dude.
Thanks, bro. Peace. Ben Prentice, co-founder of What the Fuck Happened in 1971, outlining the history of inflation and central banking right here on the Bitcoin Matrix podcast. And thank you for listening. If you dug the chat with Ben, please subscribe, like, and review my YouTube channel and wherever you dome your pods. Those reviews are the best way to get the word out so I can keep grinding out thought-provoking conversations on Bitcoin and money. And if you're interested in sponsoring the show or just want to shoot the shit, hit me up. My DMs are open. This is said. Big up.